welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 127. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm looking at a couple of lesser-known English films, which are, in spite of their lack of high profile, are quite interesting. The first one is a murder mystery called Green for Danger from 1946, and the stars Leo Jen, Trevor Howard, and Alastair Sim. And the second one is from 1950 and is called So Long at the Fair, starring Gene Simmons and Dirk Bogart. It's another mystery. It's not a murder mystery, but it's a different kind of mystery, and it's a bit interesting. So sit back, grab a coffee, get your headphones adjusted comfortably, and we'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast of old movie appreciation. There are only two rules. The first one is the movie has to be at least 20 years old. And the second one is I have to like it or at least appreciate it in some way. Feedback's really, really important to us, so we'd love to get some here. And the contact details are you can email feedback, a voicemail if you like, to kultguru@gmail.com, kultguru@gmail.com. The voicemail number in the United States is 206-337-5398, so you can use that as well. Or you can put a comment through on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces. This podcast may contain adult concepts and swearing. So if you're not into that sort of thing, it may not be for you, but I do hope you stick around and listen to this show anyway. Take care and enjoy Paleo Cinema. Hi, how is everybody? We're enjoying the summertime here. The living is easy and the weather is really nice. What have I been doing? I did take a 650-kilometre drive on Friday. Just I had a special day off and I wanted to clear my head out and do my own thing. So I took off for a drive which ended up being 650 kilometers. If you're old school and live in one of those weird places that doesn't have a metric system, that works out at about 403 miles. So I went up to a place called Echuca on the Murray River, crossed over into New South Wales, had breakfast there. It was rainy a little bit, but the weather was nice, and the drive up there I went the back road, so I got a lot of hilly country roads which were quite relaxing, and played a lot of music on the car radio. I made a special playlist and played all through that and just enjoyed it. Then I went up to a town called Kahuna, which isn't Hawaiian, but sounds like it is, and it's up along the Murray River, and had a snack there and looked along the riverbank, and it was quite peaceful and lovely there. Then I went up to a place called Kerrang, which sounds like a Jack Kirby sound effect, but isn't. And then drove back down through the country roads back to Melbourne. Started out about 6 in the morning and got home about 3 in the afternoon. And it was a good, long, stretching out, doing whatever the fuck I like kind of drive. And I really enjoyed that. I do it about once a year, usually in January, grab the extra day off that I get from work, and just clear out the pipes and just have a day for myself, which is really nice to do. Apart from that, we've survived the new year successfully. We've moved into the later new year. In fact, I'm recording this on what some people call Australia Day, which is a national holiday. It's not celebrated particularly by Indigenous Australians. It's often called Invasion Day, and there are some issues there, so I'm very ambivalent about it. I realise that, yes, it's the start of Australia as a nation when the first fleet reached Sydney Harbour and all of the convicts and the soldiers got off the ship, and all the convicts from the male convict ship met the convicts from the female convict ship and fucked like rabbits on the shores of Sydney Harbour. That's a piece of history which doesn't normally get a lot of advertising, but it's the bit I like, the fact that basically, Australia started out with a bit of an orgy. You won't hear that often, but it's the truth. So that's today. Normally, people have a barbecue, but I'm just chilling out here. I believe we are having pizza later on, according to Sal. So we're going to do a bit of a pizza feast once I finish recording the podcast. So, what have I been watching? I'll have to post on the podcast website the link for my new list of the movies I've watched during the year. I've started a new one for 2014, and it's over at Letterboxd. If you type, go over to Letterboxd and look up Paleo Cinema as one word without the dash, you'll see the films that I have watched this year so far, and they've been quite fun. Let me just see what I've got here. Got to click into it because that's always entertaining for the people who are listening at home. And the computer goes slow, of course. As you can hear, I've still got slightly rough throat, but it is improving with time. And it's not a painful thing, it's just a lot of snot and things. Let's see, what have I watched? Apart from the movies for the podcast, I watched The Seventh Victim, the Val Lewton-produced movie from back in the 40s with Tom Conway and Kim Hunter in it. I recommend that one, that's quite fun. I also watched Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the 2005 Shane Black directed movie with Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr. in it. I recorded that for ABC local radio in Darwin on last Thursday with Liz Travascus. We've started the new year of doing the movie gig, and I think Liz and I both enjoyed the movie. We had a bit of fun talking about it for 20 minutes or half an hour or something like that. Highly recommended, very meta. And a lot of fun as well. So that was good going. Let me have a look here. And I'll only mention one other thing I've watched. He said, pulling it up. I watched a 1966 Eurospy movie called Where the Spies Are, which has David Niven, the sister of Catherine Deneuve, Francois Dauliac, who died, unfortunately, after making Billion Dollar Brain with Michael Caine. In 1967, she died in a car accident. It's got John LeMessurier in it, Cyril Cusack, Eric Palmer. It's got all of the people you would go to if you were going to make an English Eurospy movie in the 1960s. I'm not sure David Niven's particularly good at being a secret agent as an actor. I think he's a little too old school for the 1960s to play a spy, but the locations in the Mediterranean are quite good. It's well filmed and directed by Val Guest, which makes it a little bit more interesting. You might remember Val Guest from things like The Day the Earth Caught Fire. Good, competent director. So I haven't been watching a hell of a lot of movies for some reason, but they're the high points since the last time I podcasted. So, on to the movies for this time around. I'm going to do them in chronological order, and the first one I'll talk about after the break is Green for Danger, starring Alastair Sim, Leo Jen, and also Trevor Howard. Écoute mon cœur parler d'amour à ton cœur. Écoute mon cœur, il n'a plus peur de ton cœur. Il te dit qu'aujourd'hui on s'aime et qu'on s'aime. Quand tu t'en vas, mon cœur s'en va avec toi. Je ne l'entends plus, je suis perdue, j'ai si froid. Sans soleil, sans chaleur, je m'ennuie et mon cœur. De mon cœur parler d'amour à ton cœur. J'écoute mon cœur, il a choisi le meilleur. thought it was time for a little bit of yeah yeah music from the 1960s. That was Ria Bartok with Écoutez mon cœur, meaning listen to my heart. And it's nice to discover little bits of music like that. I really enjoy it, and kind of getting into yeah yeah music as I do my online French language course and just start to understand the language a little bit. It enhances the process enormously. But anyway, on to the first of our movies, which is Green for Danger from 1946, starring Alastair Sim as Inspector Cockerell. Let's have a look. Sorry, I'm getting this all organized here. Leo Jen as Mr. Eden, one of the doctors. Trevor Howard as Dr. Barnes. And Judy Campbell as Sister Bates. Wendy Thompson as Sister Carter. And Rosamund John as Nurse Sanson. Okay, I'm going to get the synopsis from Wikipedia, because the one on IMDb is a bit of a dog's breakfast. Here we go. In August 1944, during the V1 Doodlebug offensive on London, a murder is committed in Heron's Park Emergency Hospital, a rural British hospital somewhere in the southeast of England. Joseph Higgins dies dies on the operating table after being injured by a flying bomb. The anaesthetist Barney Barnes, Trevor Howard, has had a patient die in similar circumstances previously. Inspector Cockerell, Alastair Sim, is asked to investigate when Sister Bates, Judy Campbell, is killed after revealing the death of Higgins was not an accident. Cockerell states at one point, "My presence lay over the hospital like a pall. I found it tremendously enjoyable." Cockerell's investigation is hampered by the conflict between Barnes and Eden, Leo Jen, because of their competition for the affections of Nurse Freddie, played by Sally Gray. After another murderous attempt is directed at Freddie, the inspector restages the operation in order to unmask the murderer.
To the Assistant Commissioner of the Police, Scotland Yard, sir. The amazing events which I am reporting may be said to have begun on the evening of August the 17th, 1944. New paragraph. A postman was cycling up Heron's Hill on his way to deliver mail at the hospital. His name was Joseph Higgins. I begin with him because he was the first to die. The hospital itself lay a mile away, an Elizabethan manor requisitioned and converted in the emergency war. Another new paragraph. In the operating theatre that night, there was a surgeon, Mr. Eden, Nurse Woods, Nurse Sanson, the theatre sister, Bates, Nurse Linley, and the anaesthetist, Dr. Barnes. August the 17th, 1944. By August the 22nd, two of these people would be dead. And one of them a murderer.
So there's your setup, Alastair Sim as Inspector Cockerell narrating the start of the movie. Well, this one's interesting for a number of reasons. I picked up the movie as I did the second movie I'm going to talk about, So Long at the Fair. There were a bunch of three movie sets down at JB Hi-Fi, which were going for like $7 or $8 each. And they had some interesting films. There were a couple of films on one of the sets that I already had a download of, but I wanted a decent copy of, so I picked it up there. And there was a triple box set of old Dirk Bogarde movies from around the middle of the 20th century. There was the one with this one in it. So I've got 9 films to play with there, and I think it cost me a little more than $20 for 9 movies. And these are quality films. These aren't your ordinary pieces of shit movies you get in these box sets. They're quite good films, and they're lesser-known films as well, so finding them sometimes a little problematic. And I thought I'd dip into this because I had Alastair Sim in it, and I recall from a few podcasts ago, Alastair Sim in The Ruling Class playing the dithering old bishop. So I thought I'd give this a go, and I found it really, really interesting. It's got some actors I like in it. who've got some interesting backstories. There are a couple of actors in this one that have got some interesting real-life biographies. Alistair Sim playing the cocky and overconfident police inspector who has something of a comeuppance right at the end of the film. I'm not going to spoil that, but watch the movie. I've posted it on paleo-cinema.blogspot.com in its entirety because the entire film is on YouTube and the quality of the print is very good. So I definitely recommend that you go and watch the film and then come back and listen to this if you are at all inclined to do so. So the ensemble cast is pretty good for the time. We've got, of course, Alistair Sim, great comedic actor, the best Scrooge in A Christmas Carol ever. You've got Trevor Howard. We all know him from later in his career. This is a few years after he did Brief Encounter with Celia Johnson. So he's still good looking and the booze hasn't really screwed him over physically the way that it did in later years. And he's kind of undistinguished in this film, but he's a good jobbing actor at the time. It's only later on that his eccentricity came through and he ended up winning a CBE in 1982, died in 1998 of a combination of bronchitis, influenza, and jaundice. So cigarettes and booze did him in, as they have a whole bunch of other people. Actually, it was a year after Brief Encounter, come to think of it, because Brief Encounter was 1945, Green for Danger was 1946. 1949, he did The Third Man, of course, playing the military guy who's giving a lot of shit to Joseph Cotton, playing Holly Martins in that one. He was in a good version of The Most Dangerous Game that I like from 1956, a movie called Run for the Sun, which stars Richard Widmark, and it kind of reinvents The Most Dangerous Game plotline. It's also got Jane Greer in it. I recommend that one as well. I really should do that for one of the podcasts, because even though it's not a major film, I really like it. Of course, he he was in The Battle of Britain, Ryan's Daughter, Mary Queen of Scots, all sorts of other things. Mutiny on the Bounty, of course, in 1962. Operation Crossbow, Von Ryan's Express, The Liquidator. So, you know, a good long job. Like Roots of Heaven, he did Roots of Heaven 2 with John Huston in 1958. Yeah, I was right. It was John Huston. So, basically, he had a long career in film, even though he was a bit fond of looking down the end of a bottle. So you've got him there. Leo Jen's in this as well. Leo Jen, I found out some interesting things about. You'll know his face if you see him, if you don't know him by name. A good jobbing actor, had a long distinguished career. His war service was really, really interesting. During the war, he was commissioned in the Royal Artillery in 1940 and went up to Lieutenant Colonel by 1943. And he was part of the British unit that investigated the war crimes at the Belsen concentration camp, and later on was an assistant prosecutor for the trial for the people running the Belsen concentration camp in just before this movie was made, indeed. So he actually had an enormous part in the war effort, which is kind of cool and interesting if you're into that sort of thing, as indeed you know I am. You've got Rosamund John as Nurse Sanson, Sally Gray as Freddie Linley, the plucky, brave nurse who is part of the love triangle between Dr. Barnes and Leo Jen's character, Mr. Eden. Judy Campbell plays a sister Marion Bates, who goes off the rail and starts revealing some things about what's happening with the other characters at a dance that's held at the hospital during the film. And now she's even more interesting because she is the mother of Jane Birkin, the actress who married Serge Gainsbourg, and she's the grandmother of Charlotte Gainsbourg. So that's kind of interesting as well. So she too had a long career, did a lot of Shakespeare and Noel Coward stuff in later years, played Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest, a musical adaptation of Importance of Being Earnest in 1984. So, yeah, she's started a long dynasty of actors, in a sense. Jane Birkin, who you would hear singing sexy duets with Serge Gainsbourg in 1960s pop songs and who became an actress. And Charlotte Gainsbourg is still a jobbing actress and, in fact, made a movie in Australia a couple of years ago about a woman who kind of falls in love with a tree and also is in Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac. So she's her grandmother. But I like the film for a couple of reasons. The setting's slightly unusual from our point of view. A wartime hospital where the doodlebug V1 bombs are flying overhead and you hear the engines of the V1s and they become dangerous when the engine noise stops because you know they're kind of gliding in to crash. So every time someone hears a doodlebug, you can see everybody looking upwards and just listening and waiting to hear for that moment when the engine noise stops. Because everybody knows, can tell by how close the engine noise is, whether it's going to land nearby and potentially blow them into jam. So you've got that as part of the background. You've got those tensions of field hospital during the war, which is always interesting. You get to see a little bit of medical techniques from the time, which are slightly different than our own and a little cruder, but you can see that they're trying to do things as scientifically as they can, which is kind of interesting. And you also see what people did for entertainment at the time, the dances and the progressive dances where you never know who you're going to end up dancing with and all that kind of thing is used as a part of the plot to display the love triangle between Freddie and the two male doctors and also the character played by Judy Campbell, who is a kind of cast-off girlfriend of one of the doctors. In fact, Mr. Eden, the doctor, was it Mr. Eden? No, it was actually the Trevor Howard character, Dr. Barnes. She's kind of they had a bit of a fling and it didn't go well. And so they've kind of eased up on it. And, you know, one of those wartime things where all of the old proprieties no longer took place and people just took a bit of pleasure and a bit of comfort where they could. And there's a certain kind of male, in a sense of privilege, who took advantage of that without really any consideration of the other person's feelings, as indeed happens these days. The movie was directed by Sidney Gilliatt, which is kind of interesting too. He did a lot of films, things like The Great Centurions Train Robbery. He was very much involved in the Centurions movies in the 50s and early 60s. He did another interesting movie with Alastair Sim called The Green Man in 1956. And films like The Rake's Progress, The Story of Gilbert and Sullivan, which I've seen and is very, very beautiful. It's in colour and very interesting as well. So he had a long career with Frank Launder, who went on to make a lot of other films after Sidney Gilliatt retired in the 1960s. So Frank Launder made he was the other guy who made all of the Centurions movies with Sidney Gilliatt. But it's really well directed, and it does show us a lot of interesting stuff about the time in which the film was made, which is kind of cool. And because it was only made 2 years after the time at which it was set, it's very historically accurate for that reason. And then you get along Inspector Cockerell, which is Alastair Sim in a large fedora-type hat. He's arrogant. He's kind of a little like a predecessor to Columbo in some ways. He's a bit of a buffoon and very much doesn't take anybody's feelings into consideration. There are a couple of people who meet clandestinely in a garden and he's there listening to them. He's very good at his job, but he's very arrogant. And that arrogance does get a comeuppance as the climax of the film reveals when, after Freddie is injured in an attempt to kill her, they decide to restage the operation and find out what exactly went wrong to kill the postman on the operating table. Why was it done? Who did it? And how was it done? So it's very much in that old school mode of English murder things, which go all the way down to Midsummer Murders these days. There's still a genre that's very, very popular. But this is a really good one because it's got engaging characters. It's got a detective who basically is a bit of an ass, but does the job very well. And it's got
a plot that's very much involved in what happens during the war. It was based on a novel from a couple of years earlier by Christiana Brand, who had a long career as a crime novelist. She had a number of books, about 8 or 10 books, with the Inspector Cockerell character played by Alistair Sim. Not played in the books by Alistair Sim, but that was played by Alistair Sim in the movie. And I haven't really read them because it's not a genre I particularly like, but I don't like reading the books, but I do like the genre as a movie. If it's done well, as this one very much is, and doesn't condescend to the audience and doesn't hide things deliberately that should be known by the audience, doesn't make any of those failings that you get in other movies of this type. I do like this kind of film genre, but I don't look at it as a book genre. I think one of the flaws on it as a book genre is after the murder, nobody really gives a shit about the victim. And this is something that's been said by people like Raymond Chandler, that with these kind of things, there's no emotional blowback from the fact that somebody died. The person who dies is purely the key that winds up the clockwork of the plot. And after that, as a human being, they're forgotten. And I never really liked that as a part of a crime genre. I like deaths to matter in crime movies. I think that the person who dies has to be almost as important as the people who survive. They have to have a life of their own. They can't just be a chess piece for this kind of movie to be very effective. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, and people like Agatha Christie are the worst culprits in this, the dead person doesn't matter as a human being. They're merely there to get the engine going. And I find that a kind of wasted opportunity in a sense, because this kind of genre could be so much stronger with that emotional depth to it, whereas it's usually just a puzzle piece of entertainment. But in this one, it does matter, and it is interesting how the plot goes along. The ensemble is very good, and they're not, apart from people like Trevor Howard and maybe Leo Jen and Alistair Sim, they're not actors you see a lot in later films, or they're not kind of people who became name actors particularly, but they're very, very good at what they do, and they're very believable as these kind of characters. They've got a kind of three-dimensionality that is brought about mostly by the work of the actor rather than the work of the script, and I like that. I find that kind of helps me stay in the world of the film. So there's not too much else to say about this without doing a lot of spoilers for it, but it's worth seeing. It's a nice little mystery film. It's of this kind of genre. It's one of the best of its kind, mostly because Alistair Sim's pretty good in it, and I love his comeuppance at the end. But I think that there are some nice twists to the plot too, which kind of work really well in upping the drama of it, which doesn't always happen in these films of the time. And I think this one is one of the best. So anyway, I'm going to take a break again. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about an even more interesting film, which is So Long at the Fair from 1950, starring Gene Simmons, Dirk Bogarde, and David Tomlinson.
Been trying to find my daddy with that broke down piece of junk. Ask everyone to help me, cried help me if you can. You'll know my daddy, he's that trombone playing man. Where is my daddy? Tell me where is my daddy with that big long sliding thing. I even asked a man that played a steel guitar. He said that you don't need him to be moved 8 to the bar. He brought his amplifier and he hitched it in my plug. He planked it and he plunked it, but it just wasn't good enough. 'Cause I need my daddy, need my daddy with that big long sliding thing. Well, then a knock came at my door. I said, my daddy's back. I opened up the door, and there stood Piano Jack. He said, I came to do some tinkling on your piano keys. I said, don't make me nervous. This ain't no time to tease. Just send me my daddy. Send me my daddy with that big long sliding thing. Well, the first time he played, I asked him how it was done. He said, I blow through here, then I work my fingers and my thumb. I slide it right out, then I slide it back again, and I get a lot of wind, and then I slide it back again.
That, of course, was Dinah Washington with one of the best dirty blues that I've heard in a long time, Big Long Sliding Thing. A lot of fun, that one, particularly given the fact that Dinah Washington started out singing in a gospel choir. But on to 1950, So Long at the Fair, starring Gene Simmons, Dirk Bogarde, Honor Blackman is in this as well, and also... somebody that we know from a number of other films that I like. Andre Morel's in it, playing a doctor. So I'll get the plot of the film from Wikipedia this time, because it is quite a good one. In 1889, young Englishwoman Vicky Barton, played by Gene Simmons, and her brother Johnny, played by David Tomlinson, arrive at Paris to see the Exposition Universelle, the World's Fair, the one where the Eiffel Tower was built for. This is Vicky's first time in Paris, and after checking into a hotel, she drags her tired brother to dinner and the famous Moulin Rouge. She finally retires for the night while Johnny has a late-night drink. When English painter George Hathaway, Dirk Bogarde, drops off his girlfriend, Rhoda, Honor Blackman, and her mother at the hotel, he asks Johnny to change a 100-franc note to pay a carriage driver. Johnny loans him 50 francs and gives him his name and room number. The next morning, Vicky finds a blank wall where Johnny's room used to be. When she questions hotel owner and manager Madame Hervé, played by Kathleen Nesbitt, the latter claims that she arrived alone. The room number now adorns the common bathroom. Madame Hervé's brother Narcisse, Marcel Pontin, and the day porter Eugene Deckers back up her story. So that's basically the plot line. Johnny and Vicky go to the World's Fair. They've been travelling around Europe and they've come from Naples. And they're going to see the World's Fair because it's the biggest show on the planet. 32 million people ended up going to the 1889 World's Fair in Paris. Eugene Eiffel built the tower for it. There were immense numbers of cultural and technological exhibits there. It's the place where Claude Debussy first heard Indonesian gamelan music, which influenced his work after that. It was an enormous cultural undertaking and incredibly popular. And this movie is set dead in the heart of it, and there's that essential mystery of what happened to Johnny, which propels the movie along. Now, it's a 1950 film, a Gainsborough picture, which had that lovely lady in the little circular, oval-shaped frame at the start of it to indicate it. So it was a quality piece at the time, and I think that during the scenes at the exposition and also in invoking Paris, they do really well with that. There's a reason for Vicky to go to the World's Fair because a chambermaid she had a chat with about her brother is going up in a balloon with her boyfriend as a part of one of the exhibits. And Vicky travels there to get her to confirm her story that her brother does exist and that and to give that information to the police and the authorities so they can help her find her brother. That doesn't go well. I'm not going to say why, but it doesn't go well. And Vicky then accidentally meets Hathaway, played by Dirk Bogarde, who met his brother late at night, as it says in that précis I just read out, and they, between them, they try to investigate what happened, A, to Johnny, and B, to his room, which no longer exists in the hotel. Now, you might remember this plot line because it was also done for an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, with Alfred Hitchcock's daughter, Victoria Hitchcock, playing the role played by Gene Simmons in this movie. So I'm not going to do a spoiler on what happened to Johnny, what happened to the room, but it's a nice tale, well told, this one. I really do like it. I think Gene Simmons was always an intelligent actress. I talked about her a little bit when I did Guys and Dolls on the podcast a while back, and I talked about how she was really good at portraying intelligent characters. She was also in another movie that I talked about on the podcast in very early days, a film noir called Angel Face from the early 1950s with Robert Mitchum in it, where she plays a femme fatale of a very particular kind in the film, and there's a terrific ending to that movie as well. But in this one, she carries the whole film brilliantly. One of the interesting things about the film, and it'll be demonstrated by the clip I'm about to play you, is the fact that when people are speaking French, there are no subtitles to it. They just speak their bits of French, and the plot moves on. Now, in the process of doing my online French course, I've managed to follow what they were saying in those little bits. It's not tremendously essential that you do, but I found that it kind of was a revelation for me to do that, because I hadn't been able to do that previously when anyone spoke French in a movie. But in this one, because the people are speaking French with slight English accents, it does help me. And I did follow what was said by the characters, even though it's very kind of rudimentary French. I got a little extra thrill from being able to follow that, which is kind of cool. And for me, it kind of justifies the effort I've put in doing my online French course, which I'm in the process of doing. So that's an extra bit of squee. But anyway, I'll play the clip. This is where a commissioner of police goes to the hotel and talks to Madame Hervé to try to find out what's actually happened to Vicky's brother, Johnny, played really interestingly by David Tomlinson.
Madame Hervé?
Oui, monsieur.
Je suis le commissaire de police.
Oui, monsieur.
Vous parlez anglais, madame?
Un peu.
Très bien. Then we shall all speak English so that Mademoiselle Barton may understand us.
Yes.
You have some place where we can speak privately, madame?
This way, monsieur le commissaire. Narcisse.
Oui?
Monsieur le commissaire veut nous parler about Miss Barton.
Bonjour, monsieur le commissaire.
Bonjour. This is purely a formality, you understand, monsieur?
Oui, monsieur le commissaire, oui.
You have a young English visitor staying here, a monsieur John Barton.
No, monsieur, we have not. You see, they deny it.
Patience, mademoiselle. We are doing our best to find the truth. Mademoiselle insists that she came here with her brother and that he has disappeared.
That is not all she says, monsieur. She says also that his room disappeared during the night. His bedroom, monsieur. Like that.
Why do you think she should say this if it is not true?
Because she's a little mad. That's why.
I told you they'd say that. Make them tell the truth. They did see him.
Calm yourself, mademoiselle. We are doing all that is possible.
I do not think mademoiselle is mad. I think there is a much simpler explanation.
Oh, what is that?
I think mademoiselle has come to the end of her money. It is much easier to make accusations than to pay one's bills.
That's not true.
How much money have you, mademoiselle?
I'm not sure about 25 francs. I think my brother kept the money for both of us.
You see?
It's not that, I tell you. How could it be?
Monsieur le commissaire, do you wish to see the hotel register?
If you please. You know that mademoiselle has been to the British consul?
But of course, monsieur. I gave her the address myself. I have done everything I can for her.
Monsieur le commissaire, voyez-vous-même. Voyez?
No, mademoiselle, your brother's name is not here.
I know that. I told you he'd forgotten to sign it.
Now listen. I am old enough to be your papa. And I have no interest in this matter except to see justice done. Is it not so?
Yes, of course.
Very well. Then I tell you. Perhaps the best thing is that arrangements are made for you to go home to England at once. Possibly your brother will be there when you arrive. If not, we will find him, never fear. And I personally will report to the British consul what steps we have taken. Voilà. Does that not satisfy you, mademoiselle?
Nothing will satisfy me until I find my brother. Of course you don't believe me. Nobody does. But I shall go on until I do find him. Do you understand?
The other thing I like about that clip is that when the French characters are speaking English, their sentence structure is French, and their word choices are literal translations of French terms. So it's kind of cool there, and it kept me in the movie. David Tomlinson's very good in the early scenes playing the brother. He teases his sister. He's pretending to be blasé about going to the exhibition. And the relationship and rapport between the two of them really sets up the fact of Vicky's obsession to find him later on, and explains it. It's all there because of their previous relationship when they're going out to dinner and going to the Moulin Rouge and travelling into Paris. The kind of rapport really is the engine that pushes through the plot line in a really interesting way. The film isn't black and white. Well, it would have been nice in colour, but that's how things were in those days, particularly with a film like this. But there are some nice forced perspectives and special effects work to put through the exhibition. And I was actually looking up a little bit of research about the 1889 exhibition. And it's occurred to me that when Sal and I visited Paris in 2004, which is 10 years ago now, we're going to have to travel some more when we get the money. But we walked the length of where the exhibition was. There's a great big peace park that leads down towards the Eiffel Tower. And we walked through the same space where the Paris 1889 exhibition was held, which is kind of cool. I always get a thrill from weird shit like that. But the supporting actors in this film are very good as well. There's Kathleen Nesbitt, an actress who had a very long and distinguished career, playing Madame Hervé. Marcel Poncin, playing Narcisse, her brother, is quite a menacing presence. He died a couple of years after the film was made. Very young Honor Blackman, playing Rhoda, who is the Dirk Bogarde character, George Hathaway's fiancée at the start of the film. Of course, not by the end of the film. This is how these movies go. And it's interesting to see Honor Blackman in an early role, because most of the things we know from The Avengers, Goldfinger and things like that took place when she was in her mid-30s, or late-30s even. And she, to me, looked better when she was slightly older. But in this one, seeing her as a very young woman was quite interesting as well. And, of course, she's had a career all the way up to 2013 at least. In 2012, she did Cockneys versus Zombies. So she was in it as well. Zena Marshall playing Nina, the chambermaid, is quite interesting as well. She had a very long and distinguished career. Felix Aylmer, a great old British character actor, playing the British consul to Paris, has some nice scenes as well, and he always looked good in that kind of Edwardian and Victorian era clothing. And he does well. And then we get André Morel coming in towards the end of the film as Dr. Hart, an English doctor. And André Morel, we know from things like Plague of the Zombies and Quatermass and other things like that, is a really interesting character actor. And I was thinking about it, there are a certain type of actors who movies are less if they're not in it, and I think André Morel's in that category. I really like him playing an actor. He speaks French fluently. With the first line, André, I'd be surprised if he didn't. And even he's contribution is welcome, and it's nice seeing familiar faces in these things as well. But because it's a Gainsborough picture, they really did tremendously well with the set designs and the layouts, the gas lanterns and the set designs for the hotel, the street scenes, the Moulin Rouge, the restaurants. They really give that period feel, and there's a depth and a texture to the set designs and the set decoration that really carry this across tremendously well. I was just thinking about it. This movie was made in 1950. So it was talking about things that happened 60 years before the time the movie was made, which for us would be people in the 1950s, in the early, mid-1950s, are as far away from us as this movie was away from the events of 1889 in Paris. So it's kind of interesting to get that perspective as well. But I really like this movie. I like the mystery as well. The mystery does have an incredibly logical, if nasty, explanation. And the movie doesn't necessarily end on a positive note. It doesn't end decisively one way or the other. Without giving a spoiler, I'm not going to say why. But it doesn't kind of turn into a soft and gushy ending, which is great because it would have kind of minimized all the things that had happened before and all of the things that Vicky as a character went through. Now, Dirk Bogarde in this film is very much a supporting character, but he's very good. There are things where he has to climb down balconies and on ropes and play the athletic hero kind of thing. And there's a nice little suspense bit where he has to break into the safe of the hotel to find some information, which is really, really well set up and really well played and well directed as well. And I haven't mentioned the fact that this movie was directed predominantly by Terence Fisher, who later went on to make all of the classic Hammer horror films, things like The Curse of Frankenstein and Dracula and things like that. These are all Terence Fisher joints, which is quite good. But even at the stage he started making, he didn't do Frankenstein. Yeah, he did Dracula. He did The Mummy, Revenge of Frankenstein, Hound of the Baskervilles, Curse of Frankenstein. But by then he'd made a ton of movies going back as far as 1948. All jobbing English ones. He did The Four-Sided Triangle for Hammer. He did Spaceways, which is an interesting one, which stars Howard Duff and Eva Bartok. And later went on to make everything right up to 1973 with Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. But in this one, he does a terrific jobbing thing, and the suspense scenes, mostly featuring Dirk Bogarde, are very well set up and well lit. And for I'm not sure who the lighting designer was in this film, but the lighting is great because it's not in the nighttime scenes. It gives you that feel of gaslighting, even though it is a black and white film, which I enjoyed. It kind of just adds that verisimilitude to the whole thing, which a lot of films don't bother with. You see a lot of modern films set in Edwardian and Victoria times, and the lighting just isn't right. It may be too bright, it may be too dark, but it's not quite what it should be for that kind of film. And this one is. And I do like the mystery. As I said, it's an old urban legend. It's based on an old urban legend. And the novel that this movie was based on, which was by one of the co-writers of the script, Anthony Thorne. It's called Maybe You Will Remember. But the movie isn't entirely serious. There are some lighter moments in the movie, as when Dirk Bogarde starts to reveal what actually happened. There's a little comedy scene with a drunken older lady whose hotel room Dirk Bogarde's character Hathaway had to break into, which is played comedically, even though the ultimate revelation is quite a serious one. They do have that light touch in there, and they do balance things nicely. Now, at the time, this is really fun. The people at the studio were trying to play up the possibility of a real-life romance between Gene Simmons and Dirk Bogarde, who was a romantic lead actor in England at the time. Of course, Mr. Bogarde was gay and closeted for his entire life, even though he did do a film in the early 1960s called Victim, which I'm going to do on the podcast as well with David Cummer in a future episode. But they played up the romance between Gene Simmons and Dirk Bogarde and tried to use it as a bit of the publicity machine. Gene Simmons at the time ran away with Stuart Granger, and they were married and made a bunch of movies together as well, so that didn't really play out ultimately. But it just goes to show that phenomenon is not exactly an American one. It's something that movies studios did in various countries to try to put a mask over the actors they had who were gay, and B, to play up the publicity to make the movie more popular. And this one was popular at the time. There is the argument that it's a chick flick in a sense, but I think that's to minimize it. And I think that chick flick as a term, except in certain extreme circumstances like Sex and the City movies, is a derogatory and dismissive term. I think this is a good, solid story, and it does happen to have a female protagonist. And it does have an undercurrent too, which is interesting, of Johnny, the brother, is actually the ward. She is his ward. Vicky is her brother's ward, because the parents have died and he's of age and she isn't. So he has control of all the money, so she doesn't have any money, as it said in that clip, and is a kind of powerless person in the scenario, and has to really push and to prove that she is right in what she says, that she's telling the truth and the other people aren't, even though she doesn't understand why. And when she, and the kind of downside to it, of course, is that it's only when Dirk Bogarde's character comes along and verifies it that she gains an ally, and the ally does most of the detective work from that point on to find out what actually happened. But there's an argument for and against that. Against it is, of course, the fact that he then takes a certain amount of the power away from her as a female person. But on the other hand, he lives locally, he has the connections, and he's able to go back to the hotel when she can't. She's been, they've given her money to go back to England, which she doesn't do, but she can't go back to the hotel except hidden, as a mask, during a mask ball for the exhibition. So the plot does give a justification for him doing more of the heavy lifting to an extent in the latter part of the film. Though there is the argument against that as well. But having said that, I find it a really interesting film. It's a minor film in the history of cinema, but it's a good story, well told, and it evokes the time and place in which it's set in a really good way, even though the budgets, on as these things go, wasn't enormous for this film. It was still a good, honest flick, and it made a lot of money at the time, and it doesn't outstay its welcome. At 86 minutes, it's just the perfect length for this kind of a film. With a mystery like this, where the explanation is something that the viewers are hanging out for, you don't want to draw it out too long into a 2 hour or 2 hour plus movie, because they'll start not giving a shit about it. This one doesn't do that. This one really does let you enjoy the mystery, enjoy the unraveling of the mystery, and enjoy the characters as they unravel it at just the perfect length of that kind of a thing. So that's about it for So Long at the Fair. You can find it around the place. It isn't on YouTube, I've checked, but I've found this inexpensive copy of it, and I'm sure that it's not that difficult to acquire if you look around. But I recommend you do, because, again, it's not nothing enormous. It's not like a few podcasts ago where I did Lawrence of Arabia. But it's a good, honest film. It's a lot of fun. And I like the mystery. I'll be back in a moment with some feedback.
Do you need one go to verrai? Dimmi quando l'anno, il giorno e l'ora in cui forse tu mi bacerai. Ogni istante attenderai, fino a quando d'improvviso ti vedrò sorridente accanto a me. Se vuoi dirmi di sì, devi dirlo, perché non ha senso per me la mia vita senza te. Dimmi quando tu verrai, dimmi quando, e baciando mi dirai, non ci lasceremo mai.
senso per me la mia vita senza te. Dimmi quando tu verrai. Dimmi quando e baciando mi dirai. Non ci lasceremo mai, non ci lasceremo mai, non ci lasceremo mai.
That, of course, was the original version of Quando, Quando, Quando by Tony Rennie from the movie Appuntamento in Riviera from 1962. And it don't get more obscure than that. Feedback time. Yes, I've actually got some feedback, and the first bit of it is from Europe. It's from Armin in Germany, and he says, "Hi, Terry. I hope you're doing well. I just wanted to thank you for your wonderful show, which is something very special in the myriad of movie podcasts. I've recently grabbed Bedeker's Seven Men from Now. I would never have purchased it without listening to your discussion on this pretty good Western. I was never a fan of Randolph Scott, but this was definitely a role made for him, and Lee Marvin was just great, as was the amazing Rocky Landscape. I'm currently browsing through the extras on the disc. Maybe I manage to send a voicemail one of these days. Regards, Armin." Thanks for that. That's what I'm doing this for, Armin, is to hip people to the interesting and good movies that are out there. Maybe it's not the best movie ever made, but it's something that's off everybody's radar and but will entertain them. So I'm really glad that that you feel that way about it, and I'm glad that you're getting into Bedeker, because it is good stuff. It really does have a certain something which is worthwhile and enjoyable. Here we go. And speaking of exotic locations, I've got another one from John. "Hello, Terry. This is John again from the Cayman Islands. I've just finished listening to the last Paleo Cinema podcast, during which you read out my feedback. Imagine my surprise then when I realized that in the same podcast that you promised to be more vigilant in vetting your soundbite inserts, you actually did it again. After playing a repeat of an excerpt from The Ruling Class, you announced that it had been a very creepy version of a song by Del Shannon. However, since you did not make your promise to be more vigilant until after that slip, I shall forgive you." That podcast, the one with The Ruling Class in it, I've re-uploaded, by the way, and I've fixed it up so it does have the insert of Del Shannon singing "Go Away, Little Girl." So people can download that one again, and it has been amended. Back to the feedback from John. "On the matter of The Ruling Class, I remember seeing that movie back in the mid-70s on TV in the UK, and apart from the fact that I recall it being somewhat weird, I do also remember that its showing created a bit of a furor in England at the time, not because of its content, but because it was the first movie to be shown on TV that violated some unwritten rule that no movie could be shown on TV until it was at least 5 years old. I guess The Ruling Class was a watershed film in that it opened the floodgates to what ultimately became cable TV practice of showing movies pretty much immediately after they ceased to be shown in theatres. One final picky point. You announced the Last Martian Drive-In podcast as being 125 instead of 25. Don't say that I don't hang on your every word. Cheers, John." Okay, mea culpa on that one too, John. The weird thing is the Paleo Cinema is at 127 this time around, and Martian Drive-In Podcast is at 27, because I started Martian Drive-In Podcast after I hit 100 on the Paleo Cinema Podcast, because I wanted to do a podcast about different things and I wanted to talk about more recent films. So I'm going to have to be very assiduous, because I know people are listening now. I know that you're going to police that thing, John, and I don't mind that you do, and thank you for caring that much, and I will fix things up as they are brought to my attention, but I will try not to do it in the future. And in fact, what I'm doing is I'm listening to the clips after I paste them into the sound file now, so I'm being a little more careful with that. And it's all because of that honest and heartfelt and well-meaning feedback. Tim Leiby also dropped a note at the Martian Drive-In. At Paleo Cinema website, paleo-cinema.blogspot.com, saying, Terry, Winter Kills is available on DVDR on demand from Amazon for $21.99. I went ahead and ordered it before I saw what it was. I decided to get it anyway and see how it looked and what it comes with. Like, does it offer the documentary you mentioned? I'll let you know once I've taken a look. I saw the movie decades ago at a Horton Plaza triple bill. Back then, Horton Plaza was San Diego, California's version of New York City's Times Square, and often doubled for it in Hollywood movies. Back when I wasn't sure what the fuck I was watching, I wondered if I... I wonder if I'd get it better now. You probably will, Tim. It's a funky film, and it's kind of... not perfect, and it was cut to pieces, as the documentary indicates. But it's an interesting piece of work, and it kind of fits quite well with things like the Parallax View and those other conspiracy theory paranoid thrillers of the time, which were very much part of the zeitgeist in the late 1960s, early 1970s. So let me know what you how you went with that one. Now, let's see if I've got anything else happening here. I've got another one from Armin. Here we go. Dear Terry, after enjoying your wonderful podcast for a while, I just wanted to say hello via email and thank you for your insightful and entertaining hours listening and learning about our common fascination, movies. I think your podcast is a pretty unique endeavor in the colorful world of current movie podcasting, and it's definitely in the upper tier of the most informative as well as likable podcasts, together with Silver and Gold, hi guys, the GGTMC, hi guys, Outside the Cinema, hi guys, and the B-Movie Cast, hi guys. It's always great to learn more about the creation and backstories of existing movies and to get to know previously unknown gems too. It's really noticeable and amazes me every time how much work and preparation enters into each of your episodes in Paleo Cinema as well as the Martian Drive-In podcast. In addition, the great choice of music is a big benefit. I sometimes found that a more prepared and technically interesting team of podcasters, not to name names here, may show the tendency to get a bit highbrowed in a discussion of movies, but this is never the case in your presentation. Your podcasts enable me to focus on the more watchworthy movies of the last century. In a way, watching more of the older films unluckily points out the flaws and problems of the more recent Hollywood output even more. Bad editing, shallow characters, non-witty dialogue, over-reliance on effects, etc. While writing this, I wonder what's your opinion about one of the most discussed directors in our circle of movie lovers, Nicholas Winding Refn. I'm a fan of his work and approach to presenting content, but had a difficult time with some of his output. This never went so far that I dislike any of his movies, but just brought me to the point of needing and wanting to re-watch his films. I also enjoyed the split opinions of lovers and haters discussing his movies on IMDb or on the Book of Faces. In his case, it never went for me so far that I enjoyed interviews with the director infinitely more than his actual work, like in the case of Werner Herzog. Anyway, again, my congratulations on your great work and best wishes from Germany/Netherlands. I'm crossing the border every day and thus have a foot in both countries. Warm regards, Armin. Yeah, Nicholas Winding Refn, I did watch one of his movies this year, which was Only God Forgives. And to be honest with you, I think that Ryan Gosling let it down. I think Ryan Gosling's face needs to move a fuckload more than it does. I really think that he's overrated. And I think I've said that in a previous podcast. But I did enjoy Driver, even though it did, of course, have him in it. Sorry, it's Only God Forgives, isn't it? I did enjoy that, not for Ryan Gosling, but for all the other people in the film. You know, people like Albert Brooks and people like that. And you can say the same thing about Only God Forgives with Kristen Scott Thomas stealing the movie away from Ryan Gosling, except for that little Thai guy who's playing the cop. He stole the movie away from Kristen Scott Thomas, of course. But I think he's a director who's doing things he's very much his own way. And in that, I can't really criticise him because he's an original filmmaker. I'll probably have to watch a couple more of his movies to really get a tap on whether I like him or not, and probably need to see something of his like Bronson, which doesn't have Ryan Gosling in it, because Ryan Gosling's pissing me off at the moment. But yeah, I think that his films are individually visioned, and that's a credit to him. But that's about it for the feedback and about it for the podcast. Thank you to everybody who left feedback and everybody who liked us on Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. Really, I'm enjoying doing this a lot, and I will continue to do so. And I'll, as soon as I can, when I can get some copies of the talks I'm doing on the radio with Liz on a Thursday night, I'll pop those in as well. We'll get a bit of that kind of thing happening. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. If you're up north, stay warm. If you're down here, stay cool. Enjoy your movies. Share the love of movies with people whose opinions you care about. And if anybody says to you, I don't watch movies with subtitles, or I don't watch black and white films, you know, A, don't sleep with them, and B, disregard anything they ever say about films until and unless they improve their attitude. So having said that, go away, enjoy yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye.